I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Many of the demonstrators protesting the DNC last week in Philadelphia carried anti-TPP banners and signs. Their candidate, Bernie Sanders, has been an outspoken critic of the Trans-Pacific Partnership before and during his presidential run. Here he is in April 2015.
Now, it's one thing if somebody woke up and said, you know, let's try this idea. Let's try the idea of unfettered free trade and see what happens. We tried it. It failed. No TPP.
Many of Donald Trump's supporters also oppose TPP, although probably not for the same reasons.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is the greatest danger yet. The TPP, as it's known, would be the death blow for American manufacturing. It would give up all of our economic leverage to an international commission that would put the interests of foreign countries above our own.
That was Trump speaking in Pennsylvania in June. President Obama is making the trade deal the centerpiece of his last year in office, hoping to get it passed by Congress before the end of the year, and that's looking harder and harder. So what is in the thousands of pages of TPP? And we asked William Malden to join us. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He writes about international economics and trade, and he is joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And William Malden, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
So who has read this document?
Well, I think some people, probably the lawyers, have read the entire document. And, of course, many specialists and industry groups, farm groups, have read the individual chapters that apply to them. Certainly the politicians probably haven't read it, but perhaps some of their aides or lawyers have as well. Hillary Clinton came out against the deal before the text was made public, so probably she didn't have a chance to read the agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, before the text came out.
How much have you been able to read? I know there were some WikiLeaks that revealed some of this information.
Sure. Well, I've read bits of it here and there, very detailed sections that apply to pharmaceutical patents and other things. But certainly I rely on talking to both sides of an issue, whether it's the auto industry, banks, farm groups, or opponents, to get labor groups to get better ideas of what the text really means, what's the results for the U.S. and the other countries. I found that's more useful than for me to pore over the text, is to talk to people who are actually affected by it and to get both sides of the argument.
Why is it thousands and thousands, I'm assuming it is, thousands and thousands of pages long?
Well, that brings us, I mean, to what is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that helps explain how complicated and lengthy it is. It's really about three things for the U.S. It's about traditional tariffs, trade agreements lower tariffs, and in this case, the U.S. has maybe 4% tariffs on average, with the other countries in the TPP ranging from Japan to Vietnam. So we would lower those tariffs. Those countries would be able to export products into the U.S. without paying tariffs, and the other countries, Vietnam and Japan, would also lower their tariffs over time. Many of them are much higher than the tariffs we have, so U.S. products could be exported there. That's the tariff section. Second is the rules bit. This is probably most of the length of the text. This is about arguably helping U.S. companies and other companies establish rules of the road, everything from pharmaceutical patents and the length of time that their drugs are protected to e-commerce, protecting small and medium businesses or big businesses' right to ship electronically, to market electronically, and to ship around the world without running into too much red tape and customs. There's also a services section that helps to some degree, maybe not to the degree that many in the U.S. hoped, that helps the U.S. services be sold abroad, whether it's financial services or legal services or other things. This is something that there are often barriers at the border where services can be exported without a lot of red tape or certifications.
So a lot of rules in this TPP?
Sure, and that adds to the length. And finally, I guess, you know, it's seen as a strategic agreement for the U.S. and the other countries involved. The TPP doesn't include China. There's a possibility they could join at some point, but that's really not on the horizon at this point. So what it does is it unifies countries, many of them U.S. allies, in the region. It gives them standardized rules of the road And according to the Obama administration, this will put pressure on China to start adopting more Western or American-style rules of the road. All that takes up a lot of space. There's a lot of lawyers
involved.
A lot
of words there, right?
That's right.
Well, let me ask you, because even supporters and critics of both NAFTA and TPP point to NAFTA to say, look at what happened with this trade deal negotiated under the Clinton administration involving Mexico and Canada. Some saying it hurt this country, some saying it was more of a wash, and some saying that it helped the country. Is understanding NAFTA helpful for us to understand TPP?
It is. And you know, certainly many of the basic attributes of NAFTA are things that are in the TPP, although the Obama administration would argue that the Trans-Pacific Partnership has much more modernized view of investor-state arbitration of labor and environmental rights, where some of these things were more primitive or afterthoughts in NAFTA. But the basic idea is the same. You lower trade barriers. In NAFTA, it was with Mexico and to some degree Canada, which was already in a free trade agreement with the U.S., and that allows things to move back and forth. Of course, it also allows companies to build things anywhere within that trade bloc, North America or the Trans-Pacific Partnership countries, and ship it eventually with no tariffs, except in a few categories where tariffs will remain. So that can result in jobs being moved abroad or moved from one country to another, but it also results in an investment, you know, both ways in the ideal world. NAFTA, the problem with NAFTA is it's hard to, for many economists to judge what were the effects of NAFTA, what were the effects of China's economic rise, what were the effects of China joining the World Trade Organization, or the effects of the WTO in general, or also the rise of technology and the mechanization that we've seen in manufacturing. So it's everybody sees NAFTA through a different lens, and often that lens is the one that people view the Trans-Pacific Partnership through.
One hears that trade deals hurt low-skill workers in this country because they end up having to compete with workers in poor countries where perhaps they get paid a couple of dollars a day, or certainly much less than what a manufacturing worker in this country would get paid. Is there some truth to that in terms of who, in a sense, bears the cost of some of these trade deals?
Definitely, Marty. That is certainly always the case. Anyone who doesn't say that is a potential issue in the TPP is probably pulling the wool over your eyes, especially labor-intensive manufacturing with low skills. That's the kind of thing that a company can, especially if the startup costs, the investment in the factory is not that high, that's the kind of thing that can be moved to another country quite easily, whether it's Vietnam or Mexico or somewhere else. You know, paper, certain textiles that aren't protected in the agreement, light manufacturing. However, it's much harder to move a job where, you know, an advanced auto plant where the company's made a giant investment, has, you know, invested in an entire supply chain in the Midwest or wherever it happens to be. It's much harder to pick up and move that factory without thinking of a variety of costs. So, yes, definitely for some low-skilled workers, the agreement is a threat. Some Republicans and some other governors and politicians say, hey, you know, we would rather our workers are adjusted to a new job that, you know, that's more skilled or better paid. The question, of course, is how do you help workers with that adjustment?
Sure.
And how do you pay for their education and get them that new job?
You include in a piece you had recently in the Wall Street Journal, this is from the U.S. International Trade Commission, looking ahead to 2013, who would benefit and who would not benefit from the TPP if it becomes the law. The biggest winner, business services, followed by agriculture and food, retailers and wholesalers, petroleum, coal products, communications, financial services, passenger vehicle, and electricity. Those are all the winners from the big winners to the smaller winners.
By 2030, right?
By 2032, exactly. The big loser, overall manufacturing, followed by electronic equipment, metals and metal products, chemicals, machinery and equipment, wood products, and auto parts and trailers. So that gives us a bit of a picture about who would gain and who would lose if this passes in the next, 15, 20 years.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, you can already see some of these trends beginning. There's a lot of auto parts manufacturing in Mexico right now that used to be in the Midwest, you could see an acceleration of that. For example, Mexico has a lot of free trade agreements that actually make it an attractive destination for manufacturing. You might see a little bit more of that. And certainly some of these manufacturing areas, you know, would suffer. Of course, the other thing to remember is that manufacturing is now a small part of the U.S. economy. It's about a tenth of the economy. So, you know, the slight headwinds faced, you know, over a period of 15 years in manufacturing aren't going to affect the U.S. economy that much. And, of course, the gains in services would affect the U.S. economy a little bit more because so many of us are involved in the services industries. Therefore, I mean, the agreement is not likely to have a large economic impact on the U.S. overall. Many economists see a slight gain. A few not-so-mainstream economists see a slight negative impact, but the impact will be much stronger in more closed countries like Japan, like Vietnam and possibly Japan.
Part of this deal is Japan, Vietnam, Singapore, Brunei, Malaysia, Australia, New Zealand, Chile, and Peru. These are not, in many ways, these are not Mexico. And by that I mean, if you're trading with Australia or New Zealand or Japan, I mean, in many ways, these are developed first world countries.
That's right. And there's usually less opposition to doing trade agreements with developed countries with high labor costs, you know, with similar wages to our own and similar legal systems. And that's something that actually the Trump campaign has seized upon this year. They've talked about negotiating a trade agreement with the United Kingdom if it follows through leaving the European Union. The Obama administration is also negotiating with the European Union right now, a separate deal. So, in fact, we already have free trade agreements with Australia and some of the other countries like Peru, and Chile. So, in fact, there's very little upside, but definitely very little negative side with the developed countries, especially those we already have a free trade agreement with.
I mean, in a sense, kind of a wash.
That's right. It is. It appears to be a wash when you think of it in a bilateral way. Of course, you know, if we can all step back and think for a second about how supply chains are dispersed around the world and many products are produced from parts and patents and intellectual property based in all other countries. So the Obama administration and many others in trade and many business groups would argue that having a group of countries in a free trade zone together, whether it's the European Union or the Trans-Pacific Partnership, actually benefits in unexpected ways, because even if the U.S. and Australia have a free trade agreement, there's some parts and there's some components that are made in third countries. Companies have more flexibility to ship things around more cheaply, and the consumers can benefit from lower prices at the checkout counter.
That's William Malden, our guest, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. We are talking about TPP, what's in it, what's not in it, and its potential impact. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with William Malden from The Wall Street Journal about TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Let me get Elizabeth from media to join our conversation. Elizabeth, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
This issue has been followed very, very heavily by the natural food industry and people who are interested in treating themselves with herbs and availability of herbs. There's a lot of language in here people don't know that will, it's really a big gift to the pharmaceutical industry and Monsanto once again, and we're not seeing it in the languaging. It will prohibit us getting all sorts of herbs. Natural medicines come under new regulatory things that have never been introduced before, and it's just one more way this administration and all of them are selling us out to pharmaceuticals, big business, and Monsanto.
Well, Elizabeth,
one's aware of that.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give our guest, William Malden, a chance to weigh in on that. Have you looked at that?
Oh, definitely. And on pharmaceuticals, I would just say, by the way, that the big pharmaceutical companies have not endorsed the TPP yet. So certainly they do benefit from the agreement, but not enough for them to be supportive, or they're trying to engage in some leverage to get even more favorable treatment. So that it's not a perfect deal for them necessarily. As far as the big agribusinesses, Monsanto and the others, yes, definitely the TPP gives them an advantage in other countries. I mean, it doesn't really change the way that they operate in the U.S., but certainly the U.S. Farm position in terms of large farm groups and agribusinesses is that they don't like other countries to discriminate against U.S. products, whether it's genetically modified organisms or other new techniques that are used in American food production without scientific proof or, you know, some strong scientific evidence that it's harmful. So certainly the TPP tries to codify some of that science-based approach that the U.S. uses, which conflicts with other countries that use a more precautionary principle, that are a little bit more careful about what's in their food supply, even if the science hasn't caught up as to whether it's harmful. So definitely it is something that that the big agriculture community would benefit from,
and how
as
big
well as small farmers, of course.
How big a hand did Monsanto and some of these other big agribusinesses, how much of a hand did they have in writing TPP?
I don't think they wrote it, but certainly, you know, Darcy Vedder, the U.S. Trade Representative official who was overseeing the agricultural section, certainly she received input from a variety of stakeholders, as they call them, from everybody from farmers, large and small, to probably some groups that are concerned about some of these things that Elizabeth mentioned. So, but, you know, I mean, the loudest voices when you're writing a trade agreement are the companies that export the most, that sell the most product in any given area. So certainly when the U.S. is trying to strike a deal that increases the U.S. economy, that boosts incomes here, and as well as corporate and farmer profits, certainly the ones involved in the large production have a very loud voice.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call us as well, 1-888-477-9499. Let me play a clip. This is a protest that took place last fall. In fact, it was November in Washington, D.C. This is Allison Case of the American Medical Student Association speaking to a reporter at a week-long anti-TPP protest.
We're concerned about the access to medicines provisions. We're concerned about the influence of Big Pharma on the negotiations. We know that they've increased patent protections. It will make it more difficult to produce generic drugs. So we're worried that our patients won't be able to access their medicines. We're also worried about the provisions that allow corporations to challenge public laws. So that would allow a drug company to challenge a public law, or a tobacco company to challenge a public law, because it somehow impinged upon their what they want to do.
And that's a very loud protest there. But this is about patents, some concerns from at least this student who's a medical student. William, can you weigh in on that at all?
Definitely, definitely. And those are two very big concerns with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. One is the access to medicines, where, of course, you know, the pharmaceutical companies are pushing to have their patent protection and their intellectual property, even for the data that's used in producing biologic drugs, to be withheld and protected for, they had wanted up to 12 years. The TPP ended up being 5 to 8, and now the pharmaceutical companies are trying to push that towards 8. They do have leverage. It's not as much as far as I can tell, it's not as much in the negotiating process as in Congress. The deal has to be approved by Congress. Mm-hmm. Certain members of Congress, influential in trade on key committees, are very close to, you know, are very supportive of pharmaceutical companies and their intellectual property, Democrats and Republicans, especially Republicans in the TPP. And so that's led to, you know, a certain bit of leverage that the pharmaceutical companies have. And access to medicines is the other side of that. You know, if a drug is on patent for longer, if imitators can't do a similar biologic drug, you know, for up to 8 years, then that really affects the costs of national health systems and whether they're going to carry the drug. So many doctors, many, you know, humanitarian groups have questioned that. The other thing is that she mentioned is the investor-state dispute settlement, which right. allows a company to challenge a regulation of a foreign government or the act of a foreign government. And this is mainly about when the company alleges that the foreign government took its property, took its trademark, took its, you know, took its plant or did something that essentially violated the company's basic rights. In that sense, the U.S. doesn't often run afoul of investor-state dispute settlement. It's been in NAFTA. It's been in other things. There was a case with TransCanada and Keystone where the U.S. is being sued by a private company. But in general, it more often protects U.S. investors in emerging markets with bad legal systems. It's a way for companies to feel more secure investing there. Of course, the other side of that is that some, you know, including Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's had an influence, it seems, on Hillary Clinton in this respect, some see investor-state dispute settlement as a way to encourage companies or give them the green light to invest abroad instead of investing in the U.S. or another developed country. So that's a very controversial provision. I would say that the tobacco companies are carved out of that, unlike what Allison was talking about. I'm not sure exactly when that was recorded. But
it was November, actually.
Okay, so right before that. Sure, sure. In October, it was officially announced that tobacco companies will not be able to sue foreign governments over their health laws. So, even if the U.S. did something that you know infringed upon the rights of a foreign tobacco company, they would not be able to challenge it based on a health law coming out of the U.S.
President Obama has clearly made this the centerpiece of his last year in office. Signed the deal a couple of months ago, back in February. Of course, now it has to go before Congress. Is he becoming kind of a lonelier and lonelier figure in support of TPP?
Well, I think you're right, Marty, in that the conventions have revealed, you know, the Democratic convention right up there in Philadelphia and the Republican convention, that there is kind of a groundswell of skepticism about this deal in both parties' bases. In the Republican base, you know, stirred up by Donald Trump and as well as the Tea Party, who are worried about these international deals, and the Democratic Party, where of course Bernie Sanders led the charge against the TPP. So when you have the base of both parties concerned about a deal, you know, even if you have centrists, Americans, and voters in the middle who are supportive of trade, it makes it harder to get the deal done in today's polarized Congress. So essentially, you have big business groups supportive of the deal, even though pharmaceutical companies haven't yet signed on. And you have the Obama administration, which is wanting to get this done as its legacy and is hoping, you know, what is starting to appear like a long shot, or at least a certainly an uphill battle of getting the TPP passed this year.
That's William Mauldin. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's been writing about TPP and international economics and trade. And we invited him to join us on Radio Times to help us understand what's in this deal and what is not in this deal, and its potential to have effects across the country and certainly impacts around the world as well. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. William, one of the critiques is that this is a deal that was written in secret. As you said, you know, many people haven't seen it or certainly seen the whole thing. Would it be fair to say that it was secretly negotiated?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And certainly when I went to Maui, Hawaii, or when I went to Atlanta, the last two negotiating sessions, it's very tricky to get up-to-date information. Officials briefed us occasionally, but sometimes I had to work with congressional staffers, with industry groups, to try to figure out what was going on behind closed doors. But the transparency issue is a big one, and in a day and age where people can follow congressional debates on C-SPAN or online, and as well as other rules and regulations being, you know, considered by the SEC in draft form, certainly it's an issue. Business groups and officials have long said, well, hey, we need to get the best deal for everyone and then, you know, sort of present it to the public. And that if we have opposition to every little thing along the way, we can't strike a balance that pleases the whole as well. But, you know, times change, and the European Union is using more transparency in its negotiations. It's revealing its negotiating positions. It's responding to that kind of desire for transparency. You know, and the reverse of that is there's a feeling of secrecy, and old drafts are released of the negotiating texts on WikiLeaks, which is something that creates a lot of concern and leads to a lot of you know, leads to a lot of suspicions
sure.
of the motives behind it.
And when you say old drafts, meaning drafts that really are misrepresent what TPP is today?
Well, the full text is released now and is unlikely to change unless the deal is renegotiated. Many countries don't want to do that. But right. along the way, when different parts were being hashed out, if you will, old drafts would occasionally leak that were, you know, from the previous or the penultimate negotiating round. And each draft has the positions of different countries in brackets simultaneously on a variety of issues. So it's hard to know.
Yeah.
I mean, you can see which countries are technically advocating which positions, but some of those are advocating extreme positions, you know, knowing that the compromise is likely to be somewhere in the middle. So it's really hard. It's really hard to read. But probably there would be a way to. According to critics of the deal, there is a way for officials to keep people more involved about the details of the negotiations and what the U.S. is really driving at.
I do want to get some more callers and I have some comments here as well. But let's say it doesn't pass. President Obama moves on and it's not passed by the end of the year. Does it still continue into the next administration or is it up to the next president to keep this going? And if not TPP, would it in a sense be business as usual what we have today?
Yeah, thanks so much for the question. I mean, it's an interesting one. Certainly, there are some elements of the business community and the Obama administration who are saying, look, Donald Trump opposes the deal and all trade agreements. Hillary Clinton has sort of increased her level of opposition to the
yes.
TPP, which is something we saw at the Philadelphia convention, to where many believe that she'd be unable to simply adopt it or simply make a few tweaks and accept it someday. You know, she's certainly not as opposed to trade as in general trade agreements as Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. But so that's the argument of some in the business community and some in the Obama administration is, hey, this is the last chance to do it in the lame duck session after the election, assuming Hillary Clinton wins and before the next president takes over. But of course, these agreements, there are a lot of strategic benefits. Hillary Clinton is aware of that. And any other president who takes the oath of office. So they have a way of sticking around. Business communities press for them. Foreign governments, you know, U.S. allies, Japanese and Canadian officials, Mexican. There's a chance that the deal could be taken up. It's hard to say if it would be the next administration or the following one. There's a fast-track legislation, also known as Trade Promotion Authority, that lets these deals be voted on with an up or down vote in Congress, no filibusters or amendments. And that can be renewed for up to 6 years total, I believe about five more years. So if the next president renews that, then the following president could submit the TPP to an up or down vote in Congress as well.
Do you dream about the TPP? It's just so layered, you know.
Well, you know, when you go to these negotiating sessions with people working around the clock and you see officials from 12 countries in the elevator and you're surrounded by reporters and lobbyists at the bar, certainly you dream about it then, you know, at these crucial time periods. I think we all do. But I would imagine that most healthy journalists would try to take a break and write about something else as much of the day
right,
as possible.
Read a good novel or something. Let me get Rose from Flemington to join us. Hi, Rose. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. I have a question. As NAFTA has allowed the tar sands people to sue for $18 billion because we didn't do the pipeline, and another case, a Williams Corporation, which was going to get gravel out of the Bay of Fundy, has sued the Fundy people for $325 million on the NAFTA arrangement. What can we expect on this loss of income angle in the TPP?
Well, Rose, let me see if William Malden can respond to that.
Thank you, Rose. And you bring up a really fascinating and controversial part of the TPP that we just touched upon earlier. Like other trade agreements in NAFTA, it has these provisions that allow investors or companies from one country to sue the foreign government of another. They can't sue to overturn a law or rule, but they can get compensation. And this compensation can run up, you know, into the billions of dollars. European investors sued the Russian government over the decision of the Kremlin-controlled company to seize the oil producer Yukos, and initially won. So certainly there is a liability there. The Obama administration has several several important economists and lawyers looking at this question. They say that the U.S. has never lost one of these cases, which is true. Yeah. The U.S. hasn't lost a single one. You know, our rules and laws in the U.S. are usually very transparent. They're according to international and domestic standards. We rarely run into trouble from foreign countries saying, hey, you know, Mississippi stole our assets, or the Food and Drug Administration did something completely unfair and out of line. And certainly foreign companies and domestic ones sue in local courts. So oftentimes the U.S., you know, faces more potential liability in regular federal or state courts than it does through investor-state dispute protection. But it is a concern. The critics say that there are more and more of these cases filed, and that that potentially someday the U.S. government could lose a case.
We're almost, we have 10 seconds here. A quick comment from a questioner saying, but don't we get cheap goods because of some of these trade deals? If we didn't have these trade deals, would the cost of a hair dryer go up, for instance?
Well, it might not go up, but it wouldn't get any cheaper. These agreements, especially the ones with China and the WTO, the TPP, which includes Vietnam, would lower the price of apparel and everything from underwear to T-shirts.
William Alden, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, getting us up to speed on TPP. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking about what's in and not in TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and now we want to get a bit more psychological. While many, maybe even most, economists support TPP, a large segment of the public is not on board with this trade deal and other trade deals. Our guest, University of Pennsylvania's Diana Mutz, has been studying public opinion about globalization, and she directs the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics at the University of Pennsylvania and joins us by telephone. And Diana Mutz, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Are you surprised that TPP has such legs this election season?
I am somewhat surprised at how it doesn't, in the sense that there's no difference between the two party candidates' stands on it. Normally, during elections, we talk a lot about the issues on which the two parties differ. And right now, but leadership on both sides is saying that they're against the TPP.
How do you study something like this? I was just talking with our guest from the Wall Street Journal saying, you know, we're talking about thousands and thousands of very complicated pages of rules and policies. How does the public understand something like TPP?
Well, as you might expect, the finer details of the TPP aren't what the public uses to make its decisions. There may be some members of the public who are extremely well-versed in what it says and doesn't say and so forth. But for the most part, what we find is being for or against free trade doesn't have much to do with the specifics of any individual agreement. When we ask people questions about free trade in general, as opposed to specific policies like NAFTA or TPP or TTIP, really, we don't get much variation. People's views are not terribly nuanced. Basically, they think it's either good or bad, and all of them are good or bad. So it doesn't seem to be based on the specifics of the agreements. Although, as I said, obviously there are experts and people who are extremely interested in this issue who may have specific, things they like and dislike.
Is it personal? And by that, I mean, if let's say you worked in manufacturing and your company moved to Mexico, I mean, obviously, that is a very personal impact on globalization or on a trade deal. Is it perhaps people that you know in your neighborhood or a member of the family that lost their job or feels like they lost their job because of some kind of a trade deal. What's the impact of that?
Well, that's probably the most surprising thing that I found in my research with my colleague Ed Mansfield, and that is that the people who have been hurt or by losing jobs or the people who are in lines of work that are potentially vulnerable due to trade are not the people most opposed to it. So on one hand, this seems surprising because I think the dominant narrative out there in the American press is, you know, person loses job, blames trade, turns against trade. But we find that that's not the case. It's not even the case at the level of, you know, knowing people or living in a community that was dominated by manufacturing where many jobs have been lost and so forth. So, you know, on one hand, that may seem surprising that people aren't forming their policy attitudes based on self-interest. On the other hand, it's actually not that surprising from a political psychology standpoint, because we have found for, you know, dozens and dozens of years that people generally do not form policy attitudes based on individual self-interest. And it's not so much that everybody is altruistic. It's that they don't connect what happens to them in their day-to-day lives to, you know, policies in Washington and so forth. And so they will operate based on whether they perceive it to be good or bad for the country as a whole, but not so much based on the individual level impact, because they tend not to connect that to the actual policies in a meaningful way. And in fact, you know, in some of the polling we've done, we found that most people don't really know if the company they work for imports, exports, or is vulnerable one way or another to trade. And so that makes it difficult to even assess your own self-interest in many cases. So certainly there are interest groups that try to help people do that by, you know, helping organize them and telling them that this is the problem that they face and so forth. But even, you know, unions, who are probably the most prominent example of that, most union members in the United States are, you know, they're civil servants, they're teachers, and so forth. And these people are not at risk of losing their job due to trade. By far and away, the biggest threat that people in manufacturing face is really due to automation, because so much of the manufacturing output in the United States has been helped by automation, but jobs have been hurt because obviously when you're replaced by advanced technology and fewer workers are needed, that is reducing the number of jobs out there.
Nonetheless, there are trade critics, trade skeptics among the public. Help us understand then the profile. If it isn't about self-interest and if it's not a more personal thing than that, What defines that person? Why do they oppose trade?
Well, they tend to be less educated, for one. And, you know, that's not about the kind of job they have. It's about sort of their overall understanding of why we do trade to begin with. What we find, surprisingly, is that, you know, unlike economists who see trade as a win-win kind of proposition, most Americans see trade as a form of foreign aid. They see it as helping other countries at the United States' expense. And that's about 50% of the public that views it that way. And the obvious question, you know, you have to ask when you see that is, why do they think we do it?
Right.
Then? Do they think we're just super generous people and want to,
or
know,
foolish?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, there is a widespread belief that it's helping others at our expense, in that the kind of open-ended responses that we get quite frequently are, you know, you need to put America first, you know, need to help our own people, and so on and so forth. And not helping those other people, those foreigners. So, you know, it's interesting because it does help people overseas as well as us, but Americans in general are pretty poorly informed about the impact that it has on consumer goods in the United States, on all kinds of things. So it's, you know, we're accustomed to low-cost consumer goods in this country. We're accustomed to a lot of the benefits of trade already. And not everybody, as a result, is aware of the benefits that we reap from it. And some other countries that have not had widespread, you know, consumer goods that were within reach cost-wise and so forth, they are far more aware of that than we have been. So it's a difficult thing because it's a complicated issue.
This sure is.
The global economy is not something any one person, I think, can claim to have a comprehensive understanding of. So expecting, you know, the average American to understand the ins and outs of trade is asking a whole lot.
Looking at some of the research you've been doing, and you touched on this earlier about a sort of a sense of nationalism and I guess a fear of giving something away to benefit another country. I wonder about things like an isolationist point of view. And I wonder, too, if there is a racial component to people's opposition to some of these trade deals.
There is. I mean, we do find that, for example, when we measure the attitudes within the United States of domestic racism, just how whites feel about blacks and Hispanics, or how Hispanics feel about blacks and whites, and so on and so forth, that's a really strong predictor of trade attitudes, even though it doesn't ask people anything about foreign countries or, you know, anything international per se. And what's going on is that, you know, some people think more in terms of us versus them. And when you think in those terms, trade seems like, oh, we're helping them at the expense of us. So the same kinds of tensions undergirding, you know, in-group, out-group tensions domestically also lead to much more negative trade attitudes. And it's surprising, for example, to many people that minorities in the United States are much more pro-trade than are whites. Yeah, and of course you would think, oh, but wouldn't they be more likely to be in the kinds of occupations that would be hurt by trade? And interestingly, because there is this in-group, out-group component, and they're much more, much less likely to be anti-outgroup, they tend to be more pro-trade, even, you know, after taking into account all kinds of other things. So it is different, I think, than the dominant narrative that we get from reading the newspaper, watching television. And I think part of that is the inherent complexity of the issue. When you talk about job loss due to trade, it's pretty easy to do a really emotional kind of story about somebody, as you say, who lost a job or their factory closed due to trade. And that does happen. You know, we know that there's a lot of job dislocation, people losing jobs and having to move to other lines of work due to trade. But when you do a story on job gains due to trade, which there certainly are, how do you do an equally compelling story? Because it's several steps removed. Almost no one knows when their job was actually created as a result of export markets and so forth. So it tends to be discussed mainly in terms of, you know, graphs of job gains and so forth. But that's not really a human a story.
No, we don't respond to graphs in quite the same way. That's Diana Mutz, director of the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics at the University of Pennsylvania. She's been studying globalization, and we've been talking about TPP trade deals during this hour. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We have a comment from David. He said, in fact, he commented near the top of the show. He says, Greenspan was an economist who told us trickle-down was good for the middle class and the poor. We all know how that turned out. Why should we believe these economists who are telling us this deal is good for us? And Diana, this is, you sort of referenced that earlier, which is that many economists feel that it is, but somehow that message does not connect and resonate with the public.
Yes, because I think it's very hard to track the connections that ultimately make it good. And I think, you know, it's not that we don't have economic problems in the United States or that, you know, the middle class or manufacturing jobs haven't declined. Those kinds of things are real. But the idea of blaming it on trade or trade agreements in particular is what's often mistaken. And I think You know, if protectionism were really the cure, that would be one thing. But instead, what that risks is even further, you know, economic problems, because we close ourselves off to international markets. We, you know, as a result, will have fewer jobs in those companies that relied on export markets and so forth. So I think, you know, we do have problems. We have a lack of an adequate safety net for the kinds of changes that a global economy produces in our country, especially when, as I said, so much of this is due to changes that, you know, we're not going to stop automation. We're not going to keep companies from doing things more efficiently if they can. And yet that is going to result in job loss, and right. It already has tremendously. So we need policies in place that can help these workers, you know, whether it's retraining or something else. And, you know, I personally don't care if it's due to trade or due to something else.
You still need
it. Still a good policy. Right.
Well, you know, Diana,
there is a tendency to scapegoat trade.
And we're almost out of time here, but we got so many people that want to join the conversation. Let me get Eli from Richboro to join us. And Eli, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to say that my main opposition to TPP as a millennial, and I know other millennials have similar oppositions, isn't in the trade itself, but it's in the other language within that puts some limits on net neutrality, and there's other issues with the way that TPP deals with internet, especially with some of the other 11 nations joining TPP having much stricter speech laws in the United States. And just there's a lot of internet issues. And that's just something I wanted to add to the conversation there.
Eli, I'm glad you did. And you're saying you feel like you speak for a lot of millennials?
Yeah, I mean, technically, according to the Pew, I'm right a year outside of being a millennial, being a little bit too young. But I know that a lot of other millennials have similar viewpoints with TPP having a strong impact on in the internet, especially with net neutrality.
Absolutely. Diana, Eli, thanks for the call. Diana, about a minute before we have to end our conversation.
Sure.
Go ahead.
I'm not an expert on the impact of TPP on anything involving the internet, but I will say Eli is unusual in that all the public opinion polls show younger people are overwhelmingly much more pro-trade and much more supportive of the TPP as well as other policies than our older people. So he may have some special information I'm not aware of, but it isn't common. Normally, younger people are a lot more open to these kinds of international connections, and we see that pattern very strongly in public opinion polls. Those who are older tend to be far more opposed.
Do you think with today's millennials, as Eli described, are just more worldly? I mean, they're more open to a lot of different things?
Well, they've grown up in a world that was far more interconnected. I certainly see that with my own kids, that, you know, they've grown up with international travel being more affordable. They, you know, have connections via internet with people in other countries, so they aren't as likely to see them as the other that they don't know and don't necessarily like. They have international friendships and so forth. So it is a new world that way. International communications means that we know what's going on elsewhere, and in a way that, you know, took months back when I was that age.
Right, back in the day. Diana Mutz,
yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Us as well. Director of the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics at the University of Pennsylvania. And that's it for this first hour of Radio Times talking about TPP. Do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.